Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our April 17th service. There is a reading by Reverend Bodie, and the sermon in song and words is by Emma's Revolution. Thanks for listening.
Our reading on this Earth Day Sunday is from a recently delivered sermon by the Reverend Dr. Marilyn Sewell. She's a retired Unitarian Universalist minister, spent many years at First Portland in Portland, Oregon, First Unitarian Church in Portland. And some of you may recall that she was here just 2 years ago. She had been sponsored by our Social Justice Steering Committee, and she gave our sermon on Social Justice Sunday, which was titled Engaged Spirituality, that had to do with how we personally address the central issue of our times, which is climate change. Well, more recently, she's given another sermon on this topic. It's called The Moral Demands of Climate Change. And in this sermon, after ticking off some of the things that hinder us as individuals from becoming part of the necessary change for the health of our, to restore the health to our planet, after ticking those things off, she asked the question, how will change come about? My reading is the last part of that sermon. It will take me about 8 minutes, but this is her answer. It's the conclusion of a very powerful sermon about how will change come about. She says, the history of progressive social movements tells us that the impetus for change comes not from the government or from business, not from the establishment, but from what is known as the third sector: schools, nonprofits, unions, churches. In other words, it comes from the grassroots, from a small number of committed individuals who awaken the conscience of the country. Consider, she says, child labor laws, abolition, women's suffrage, the anti-war movement, civil rights, fair wages. All these movements came from the bottom up. What is the role of the church? It's significant because in changing consciousness, moral arguments always trump economic and scientific facts. Unfortunately, fundamentalist and mainline Protestant churches have, for the most part, emphasized personal sins rather than systemic sins like economic inequity, racism, domestic abuse, or environmental sins which wound the earth and sicken people. A church should offer a prophetic alternative. It must ask, what gives health? What gives life? What gives hope? And always we must ask, and how are the children? We need a new narrative, a new story that defines and guides us. From the earliest settlements, America has seen herself as the promised land, the city on a hill, establishing a new and superior social order. That new order has to do with freedom and equality under the law. And it also has to do with domination of other lands and resources under the guise of saving them. These beliefs constitute a quasi-religion, not our professed theology, but in fact our functional theology, determined by what we actually hold sacred. And what do we hold sacred in this country? The market. Our civil religion has now put its faith in post-industrial capitalism. We continue to exploit developing countries for their raw products and labor. We live to buy and accumulate stuff unconnected from the source of our riches, the earth. In fact, the earth itself is seen as a commodity. This is not a system of values that is sustainable either economically or spiritually. So, if we are to imagine a new narrative, a healing story, What are the values that will of necessity ground us? First and foremost, she says, we must become radically relational. Because global warming is a phenomenon shared by all people in all places, we can no longer think of ourselves as independent agents, neither as individuals or as countries. What touches one touches all. This is a perspective that encourages us to take responsibility for the commons. Our morality must not be constrained by skin color, religious persuasion, language, ethnic or class background. It is not enough to say, my children, my neighborhood, my town. Our connectedness to all people everywhere will become more and more apparent, as will our dependency upon one another. And for what is a new challenge for change agents, we must consider not just the suffering of those alive now, but the needs of future generations. In other words, we must develop a consciousness of generational justice. I remember, she says, being moved by Robert Flaherty's Nanak of the North. That was a film often referred to as the first documentary. The protagonist, Nanak, moves through the wilderness of North Canada, hunting, fishing, building an igloo. I recall, she says, the challenge, the courage, and humanity of this Inuit who considers the next hunter or fisherman who may happen by and leaves each shelter or site more hospitable than when he found it. He sees himself as responsible for those unknown ones who will come. Our ethic of stewardship must extend to those nameless ones who will follow us, those who will be born and live and love and die largely dependent upon our care for the earth they happen into. And last, we must become foolishly, irrationally hopeful, because we do not have the luxury of despair. What is the source of this imprudent hope? It is grounded in the life force itself and from the earth and from the faith that is called forth when we face impossible odds, odds that would make any halfway reasonable person admit defeat. We are called simply to be faithful. We cannot count on the fruits of our labor. We do what is right solely because it is right. Our faith stands in contrast to all that which takes, devours, destroys. It is sustained by love for the earth and for all living things. She writes, someone has said that this is a good time in history to be alive. I think I understand that sentiment. The climate crisis has given our generation a great deal of clarity about moral purpose. We have challenges that can bring out the best in us, fostering a great outpouring of creativity and compassion. We are facing destruction almost beyond imagination, and that demands a kind of faithfulness like no other we have known. We are called forth to be bigger than we are. Yes, it is a good time to be alive. And Dr. Sewell concludes on this personal note, saying, I am reminded of when I was a young woman and so joyfully pregnant. I had no question about the meaning of my life. I gave myself away to a purpose larger than my own pleasure, my own safety even. I knew that a life depended on me, that I was a container, a protector of life. I still am. So are all of us. Thank you.
Well, we're truly honored and humbled and surprised.
And we know what we're having for lunch.
This is really lovely. Pete Seeger was a great influence on us, and he said that the McCarthy era never ended. I don't know how much of his story that you know. Certainly, folks of a certain generation at least know that he was brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee because of his social justice work in the world. And he was supposed to appear on the Smothers Brothers variety show on TV. And just to give you a sense of how threatened the government was by this tall, skinny folk singer. President Lyndon Johnson called the president of CBS and said, cut to commercial, when Pete was going to sing a song in opposition to the Vietnam War. So we've known for a long time just how potent tapping into that, the moral side of the facts and figures behind the social justice work that we do, and you know, what more enticing way to do that but by using art and music and all the different forms that we have available to us to express that. What that means for artists like us is that we get sort of relegated to the sidelines of the music business as it is. And sometimes even to parts of the music business that you would think might be sort of, you know, more aware, even in the folk music world. They get very anxious about musicians that talk about issues.
We're very dangerous.
You can see. So what that means for us is that we play a circuit that we create from whole cloth, pretty much each of us individually on our own. And it is the circuit that Pete relied on. Once he went before HUAC, all of the Weavers' concerts were canceled, their entire schedule. So what they started doing at that point was going to summer camps and to universities and to the Progressive Church. And that's where his music largely remained, even with the tremendous fame that the Weavers had during that time. You know, they were they had the number one selling hit in something like 1951. All of us that follow in those big shoes, for the most part, who speak out about these issues, then rely on the grassroots to hear our message and to take that message out into the world. But I can tell you that you know, once I got a taste of that community, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. That community that really cares about life and love and the planet and one another. Those are my people, and clearly you all are our people. So we feel particularly honored to accept this award and to be with you all this morning.
And we feel very grateful to the Green Sanctuary Committee for giving us this opportunity to share some of our experiences with you and some of the work that we do through music for social justice. So when you're an activist singer, and I guess first we could look at that word. I remember singing at a university, and the professor, kind of to break the ice, said to her students, well, what do you think of when you hear the word activist? And they said things like, oh, a white person who wears dreadlocks and Birkenstocks and tie-dye and all of that stuff. And but clearly there's a lot more room in the world for this concept of activism. And we're going to be telling you how we do it and also giving you some ideas about, you know, to support you in being the activist you want to be in your world. But as activist musicians, we're not always singing in such a beautiful place. In fact, we're not always often singing inside anywhere. We've sung in concerts and at demonstrations across the country, from Florida to Alaska. And when we're doing demonstrations, we've done everything from the smallest kinds of things, demonstrating on a corner in Nashville when the Trinity Broadcasting Company was trying to take over the FM stations on the lower end of the dial, where usually the progressive radio exists. And that was only a few of us on that corner in Nashville. Being part of a first peace rally in a military town in Delaware, where there were 100 people who got there and who came there to speak and walk through those streets and say, yes, we've been a military town and we know that we need peace. All the way up to singing at demonstrations in Washington, D.C. on the Mall, where there were 500,000 people. And maybe you didn't hear about it. Because there is this sneaking way in which the numbers get kind of fuzzy when they're covering what's considered activist and progressive. If you've ever been at a demonstration and then watched the news coverage, you might wonder if you and the reporter were in the same place. And this particular song that we're going to sing with you has a part for you to sing. We wrote to sing at a demonstration at the state capital of Maryland. We used to live in Maryland. And our state of Maryland had an opportunity to become the first state to vote in offshore wind farming. And so we were there on the last night of the legislature when they were going to take that vote. There were a few hundred of us with our little light-up wind turbines and singing and speaking and being a presence for them to pass that bill. And then the vote lost by one. And that's exactly how we felt, especially because it was our representative. But it did give us an opportunity to sing this song that we wrote, you know, a few more times. And then the next time that bill came around, it passed. And so our state of Maryland did indeed vote in offshore wind farming to become the first state. And so we know that the song works. And when you're outside at a demonstration, sometimes, well, certainly there are no hymnals to follow along, so your part's going to be really easy. Sometimes there's not even a permit for an instrument, so this was all we were permitted to bring. But I'm going to sing, feel the wind, and you're going to sing back, feel the wind. There, awesome. Already practiced up. Come outside of your office where the air is also steam. Stop and remember what's beyond your window seat. All you legislators, when our future in your hands, feel the wind.
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 Feel the wind. Come outside of your office. Feel the wind.
And the lobby's toxic cash. We need jobs and power, and the answer is right here. Feel the wind.
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 Move away from the fracking. Feel the wind. Look ahead to the shoreline, to the ocean vast and blue. Beyond the breakers, to the breezes blowing through. Activate clean energy, start the process now. Feel the wind.
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 Feel
outside and feel the wind. Look ahead and feel the wind.
Pete Seeger was the founder, as many of you know, the founder of a environmental organization on the Hudson River called Clearwater. He founded that organization in 1969, a year before the first Earth Day. But Pete was inspired by the writings of Rachel Carson. And, you know, here was, to you know, most people's perception, a woman who was a concerned citizen who started noticing, because she was attuned to that interconnected web. You know, she was really aware of her surroundings and in the area in Maine and also in around her home in Silver Spring, Maryland, she noticed that something was going on. She wasn't sure at the time what was happening, but she saw that something was in fact was affecting the environment, and so she started looking into it and did really groundbreaking research on the effects of DDT. And that ultimately led to legislation to protect those places, but also to ban the use of DDT. We, of course, went on to sell it around the world, and it's still used in places like Central America. But still, it was incredibly groundbreaking. And it was very risky for her to take this position. And, you know, she was very much like you all. I actually don't know if she was a Unitarian Universalist or not, but she became quite progressive. And she was very well educated and very curious about what was going on in the world and very outspoken about what was going on in the world. And there's, you know, there are all her books that are widely available, Silent Spring, of course, among them, probably the best known of her books. There's a lesser known book about her as the person behind the research and behind the eloquent stories that brought us, so many of us, into the environmental movement. The book is called Always Rachel, and it tells the story of, it was edited by, or compiled by, the granddaughter of a woman. If you read the letters, that Rachel Carson was clearly in love with, and not a part of her story that in the early 60s could have come out to the general public. I think in many ways she must have felt very isolated in her work. But the other secret, really, that her publicist had to keep throughout that time was during the writing, while Rachel Carson was writing Silent Spring, she was also dying of breast cancer. And she was exposed in many different ways to pesticides, not only in her very hands-on research, because she was in the water taking water samples from places that were really very, very toxic, but she also lived in the greater Washington area, and we know from having lived there relatively recently for 13 years, the vast majority of the power that energy production there comes from coal. And though there's not a great deal of industry right there in the area because of the prevailing winds, a huge amount the particulate comes from the Midwest, from the and all the manufacturing there, what's left of it. That the air and the water, especially to people who are sensitive to those things, as Rachel was, is quite toxic. So they didn't announce that she had cancer until after her book was published. We used that as one of our resources, because we were asked to write a song about Rachel for the 40th anniversary of the release of Silent Spring. And her home in Silver Spring, Maryland, has been preserved and is now the headquarters of the Rachel Carson Council. And they do fabulous work, not only preserving, you know, her letters and her research, but also they have a great newsletter, and they do great work locally as well as globally on environmental issues. So we premiered this song there at the 40th anniversary celebration. And it's also actually part of, it's on one of our CDs, but it's also part of a CD that goes to fund the Rachel Carson Council in an ongoing way. She definitely was touching a nerve that, in much the same way that, that Pete, was touching a nerve. It was slowly beginning to dawn on her that there was this unholy alliance between chemical manufacturing and even the, though she didn't write about it specifically, even the prophets from the cancer industry. So this is Silent Spring. Rachel saw the changes in the coastline, in the fish, in the wildlife, the forest and the trees. She knew these were canaries in the coal mine. She felt it in her body, in the air and in the seas. Silent spring, silent spring,
silent spring.
In the air there is a silent killer creeping, wafting over all our houses, streaming in and out our lungs. And it's poisoning us now as we lay sleeping. Rachel Carson warned the nation for our daughters and our sons. Silent spring,
silent spring,
silent
spring.
Ooh, ah, yum, ah, yum, ah, yum. Ooh, ah, yum.
Companies are dumping in the sea stress,
while families spray weed killer all around their homes.
Cancer's growing rampant in the heartland,
while corporations profit from the seeds that they have sown.
Silent spring,
silent spring,
silent spring,
silent spring.
Zenitech sells pesticides to farmers. Salic earns its profits in the name of cancer care.
Rachel and 2 million women suffer,
while Zenitech bought Salic to increase its market share. Silent spring,
silent spring,
silent spring,
silent spring.
fish in the wildlife, the forests and the trees. She was the canary in the coal mine, but her voice, unlike her body, won't be silenced by disease.
Silence.
Silence, spring.
Silence, spring.
Silence, spring.
We have one more song to sing with you.
Promise we won't leave you there.
So we've sung at a ton of demonstrations, as I mentioned, things like some of those early demonstrations to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, which we've done so far, right? That's awesome. We love
for
that.
Now.
For now, it's fine. It's a good start. People used to say, oh, about the peace movement, oh, you didn't stop. You haven't stopped the war. And I would always say, you know what? The peace movement, think of where the war movement would have been if there were no peace movement, right? Other things we've been at, a demonstration to close one of the coal-fired plants, the coal-fired burning plants, outside of D.C., and we won, and they closed.
The Senate office building was powered by coal entirely, and a fairly small group of us, actually, got together and demonstrated not too far from that coal plant in Virginia, and they shut that thing down. They did not want word to get out about that.
And we were not at all the demonstrations or all of the meetings or all of the legislative work that allowed that dam here for your Elwha River to come down. Two dams. Let's give a great round of applause for that. So activism does require that radical, almost foolish sense of hope that you could have that idea, that dam has got to go. That dam is huge, right? Those dams, huge. They took a lot of money to get built. A lot of people put their effort into it. And somebody or some group of people said, we will pull those dams down and allow the salmon to, after 90 years, as Case was telling me, after 90 years, the first year those dams were down, the salmon came right back up. After all that time, that inherent knowledge of where they were meant to be moving upstream, they still held it. So these big ideas, everyone says they can't be done, right? Can we stop the Keystone XL pipeline? Can we have a $15 minimum wage? Can we have health care for all? When we say them, you're definitely going to hear people say, well, that can't be done. And we've done a lot of work with the Palestinian and Israeli organizations on both sides who are working for peace. And there are groups like that, one including one group called Combatants for Peace, which were former fighters on both sides. And when they started to communicate with each other and they set up a meeting, they each thought the other was going to be ambushing them and that it was not a meeting. But in fact, both sides did want to meet and work for peace together. And we were in D.C. singing for another group called the One Voice Movement, which is seeking to have the moderate voices on both sides who want to live in peace shared in the media. And Dennis Halliday was there, one of the ambassadors who used to work in the Middle East, and he said, people will always tell you it's the wrong time for peacemaking. But you keep doing it, because that moment that it does happen, all those people will say, well, that was the right time. So whatever it is you're working on in your community, whatever it is that you're working on for your family, for your children, for our children, just know that you keep doing that work, because then that moment, you are there. You have created that moment. And it always takes us being bigger than we are.
And every movement, every moment builds on the next. So it creates firmer ground for the next generation of activists and the next action that anybody takes is strengthened by the one that came before. So I met Pete Seeger in 1984, and we became fast friends. And
he liked cookies as much as Pat likes cookies. That was a good start.
The first time I met him, actually, I had seen him in concert a number of times before, when he came through Ohio, where I lived, not far from the Cuyahoga River, spoke about that. I mean, you've probably heard that the Cuyahoga River in Ohio was so polluted it caught fire. There was so much industry that just dumped directly into that river, as if it had, you know, didn't matter. Pete actually came to Cleveland and talked about this wild idea that he had to clean up the Hudson River. And in fact, the Hudson River today, not only do people boat on it and swim in it, but many communities along the 150 miles of shoreline, actually in drought conditions, use that water for their drinking water. I mean, it's processed, of course, but it is safe now to both swim in and even to drink in those local municipalities where it was heading the way of the Cuyahoga River for many, many years. But he came and he was at Oberlin College, and I was at school at Kent State University at the time. And I was friends with the folk music club there, so I came to meet them early before the concert. And I burst in the back door of Finney Chapel there and pulled open the door, and there was this tall figure in front of me. And I just kind of stopped in my tracks. And then a moment later, I hear, "You want a cookie?" Pete had was notorious for his sweet tooth as well as his wild ideas. So when I stood by his bedside as he was passing on with his family and a small group of friends surrounding him, we sang back to him some of his songs that he so graciously sang to us so many times in so many places around the world in his 94 years. And in those last moments, I was thinking back about all those places where Pete touched my life and where Pete really inspired in me the need to be bigger and to connect with something bigger than myself and to really be part of that interconnected web that makes this world a better, more livable place. And this is the song that we wrote for him. And he had this keen and clever and sort of almost mischievous backdoor way of convincing huge groups of people to breathe together and sing together, sing in harmony together, and then take that metaphor out into the world and make it real. So this song is very much in that tradition, so we would love it if you would join us. Even if you don't know the words, you'll pick it up and celebrate him. And thank you again for this beautiful honor. And those of you who were with us last night, thank you so much for being with us. And we look forward to the workshop. It's at 3:00, and you can still join us. I think Chris will have some, or somebody will have some tickets out there at the coffee hour. So. Thank you so much, Reverend, for having us.